Welcome everybody. Final day of board deliberations, and we are going to talk first about the disclosure initiative. This is the floor to Christine.
Yes. So we're going to be talking about papers 8A and 8B, and then April will move on to paper 20, I think it is. So Amy, you're going to start with net debt on agenda paper 8A.
Yeah, so this is agenda paper 8A, and the feedback statement from the financial reporting disclosure discussion forum identified net debt as a potential next step that the IFC could take with regards to disclosure. And so far we've been considering this as part of the amendments to IS1 project. Our recommendation in this paper is that the IFC should not include any proposal to amend IFRS in relation to net debt in the package of proposed amendments to IS1 plan for exposure in the first quarter of 2014. And we also recommend in this paper considering a net debt disclosure as part of a medium-term project under the disclosure initiative, the disclosure framework project. There are two reasons for this. Firstly, the scope of the amendments to IS1 project, which is for clarifying amendments, and we think that introducing a net debt disclosure requirement is outside the scope of that project. And secondly, we think that in order to provide a sufficient analysis and support a net debt disclosure requirement, we need to undertake further research and outreach, which could potentially delay the publication of that exposure draft. We discussed these recommendations at the recent CMAC meeting. The CMAC think that net debt is a very important disclosure, and they were supportive of the IFC pursuing this topic. They were clear that it shouldn't be part of the amendment to IS1 project. However, they did raise concerns with moving it to the medium-term disclosure framework project because of the longer-term timeline of that project, and they wanted something done in the shorter term. And feedback from other users has raised similar concerns. We do think it would be possible to look into net debt in the shorter-term project under the disclosure initiative, shorter-term than the disclosure framework project. So the questions for the IFC are set out on page 6, and the first question is that we recommend that the IFC not include any proposal to amend IFRS in relation to net debt disclosure in the package of proposed amendments to IS1 planned for exposure in the first quarter of 2014. And does the IFC agree?
What I would like to say about it is that we did create expectations about this disclosure, among others, through my speeches, in which I clearly included it in the short-term agenda. And I can understand when investors who really want this are a bit disappointed when they see it being swallowed up by a bigger medium-term project, which might take a long time. So I think it's reasonable, although I agree with the proposition not to include it in the IES1 project because it clearly does not belong there, that we should create a separate work stream that hopefully is quicker than the medium term project that is being proposed in question 2. Jan?
Well, I agree with your proposal, and I'd just like to add that the CMAC meeting, in my reading, was that I don't know if it was the majority, but almost the majority, as I read it, said that they wanted us to define the net debt. Quite a few of them said we should focus more on liability descriptions than on the net debt. So I think you are absolutely right when you say we cannot just solve this with a quick fix. And it's such an important part of analysis. I think, and I've said this for 9 years now, that pension liabilities are financial liabilities. And if we would be so brave so that we included that into the definition of how you would define net debt, we would also have solved, at least I think so, part of our pension accounting problems. So I agree.
Stephen?
And you said about creating a separate work stream, and Amy, you said about something else other than IS1 or disclosure initiative. So what is this other thing, and when does it get on the agenda, and how quickly?
Yeah. it would be another stream in the disclosure initiative. So at the moment we have some IF1 amendments,
yep,
some work on materiality,
right,
the research project on replacement of IS1, IS7, cash flow statements, and bringing the SSP project, and that's what we're calling the disclosure framework project.
Right.
And that will be looking at something on the agenda for 2015, but we're doing research until that time, and that was the project which Amy was referring to, that we were putting NetZen into. This would be, if we do it something separate, we'd create a separate stream within the banner of the disclosure initiative. So it would be something like the work we're doing on materiality, a separate component of that.
So not part of the main disclosure initiative.
No.
So potentially, therefore,
not part of that bigger research project. Part of a shorter-term project. I haven't got the slide here for you, but we said there were some short-term amendments to be done at the moment. They were IS1 amendments and some work on materiality. We could put in another stream within that, specifically on net debt.
With a, what sort of timeline?
We would look to start working on that as soon as possible. So I would expect that within this year, so next year, 2014, we would try and get a proposal for an EB within that time.
I mean, I think we should do it now, to be honest. I feel that, you know, this was proposed in FSP. These types of disclosures are commonly provided by companies, even though they're not required. We've had these frequent requests, the CMAC are supportive. I think, to my mind, there's two aspects of this. One is defining net debt and the whole difficulty of presentation. That, I think, can be part of the longer-term disclosure initiative. But the roll forward of gross debt, the roll forward of financial liabilities, seems to be something that we could very easily do now. We have roll forward of non-financial liabilities, we have a roll forward of pension liabilities, we have a roll forward of equity. The one that's missing is the roll forward of debt. And that's the bit of information that these users say is missing. They can't understand why debt has changed beginning to the end of the period, because they can't see the effect of acquisitions, disposals, foreign exchange differences, the non-cash transactions. They can see other bits and piece some of it together, but they can't see the whole thing. We also have a roll forward of cash, which is the cash flow statement. So the bit that's missing is this roll forward of debt. So I think we could do that now. I think it would be very simple without then actually having to define net debt, which has to then coincide with defining operating and financing, which is, you know, the wider disclosure initiative.
There was some discussion in the CMAC meeting that some members did say that there may be some short-term things that we could do to help the situation, that may be a symptom, a first step in what could be quite a complex decision or discussion. That sort of aligns with what you're saying.
Yeah, that's the way I would do it.
Greg,
two questions. Oh, I didn't agree with your stuff. Two questions. One question is, I remember when we developed the financial statement presentation, the proposals, on this issue, there is a geographical difference on demanding this information. Can you confirm whether my understanding is true?
I think that was something that when we said we wanted to do research into this, that's something we did want to look into. How widespread is it that people are already disclosing it, and how widespread is it that people are asking for this disclosure?
Yes, this is my previous observation, and maybe you can further investigate on this. And secondly, Yang mentioned about the difficulties, and I'm not sure because I not attend this meeting. And during the process to develop financial statement presentation project, we originally had the idea to classify operating, financing, and investing. But later on, we got problems, you know, to further disaggregate something for example, pension liability and others, whether it is financing or operating. And then we create a new category under operating, that is financing from operating activities. But if you still not over, it's because there are so many basket transactions which may involve in operating, financing, and investing aspects. For example, leasing or syndicate financing, project financing. Then board add another category called, you know, I forgot, other, you know, activities, means those activities have three kinds of features: operating, financing, and investing. And can I ask you on definition whether they involve similar difficulties as we had in the past?
Well, the SSP did try and, well, require a debt net debt reconciliation or disclosure, but it was very much based on that, the categories which the SSP had put forward. So we were hoping that maybe we could learn or take what the SSP had got to, but because we're not taking on some of those disaggregations in the SSP project, we can't. But I think those same difficulties that you're describing will come back to us, because we don't have that basis on which to apply what we're going to do going forward. So it goes to what is the liability side and what will be the asset side in that net debt reconciliation, and those same issues that you're discussing now will come back again. And another reason why we think this is a complex issue that we can't do in the IS1 project.
Among the three categories, mm-hmm. that is financing from operating activities, you know, basket transaction which have to disaggregate, and finally pure, you know, financing through issuing issue shares and others, what broad categories people are talking about net debt among the three? Or
I think it varies, and that's the work we need to do, but we haven't
this
done.
This is one of the problems.
I think we need to understand that and be able to sort of give a lot more colour to what people are actually disclosing, because I think the disclosures vary, and people's treatment and what they define as net debt varies. So we need to, as part of what we do, understand that and understand how we will react to that.
Thank you.
Patricia. I have concerns about requiring a net debt disclosure. It's a concern with why I picked this particular KPI, because there are other key performance indicators that are used in the market even more widely, and I think more globally than just this one. I don't disagree that this is an important one. But one of the things that I took away from the CMAQ meeting was that the problem was transparency into the numbers that are on the balance sheet so that analysts could develop their own, or transparency into what management is including in its net debt disclosure. And some of the things that they raised were not just operating versus financing categories of the liabilities, but where the cash is and what are the restrictions on the cash and how much tax would they have to pay if they were really going to use it to settle that debt. It's not a simple matter of just deciding which numbers to pick off the balance sheet and put them together into a ratio. It's a lot more complicated than that. And so I certainly support not putting it in the short-term project to amend IAS-1. I have serious concerns about doing a project on net debt on its own, because why that KPI as opposed to all the other KPIs? I would be supportive, though, of doing a project that looked into what disclosures might be necessary around cash and liabilities so that someone could do a net debt reconciliation if they wanted to that was accurate.
Would that fit in with Stephen's suggestion of what you call it, roll forward of liability?
Well, I have no objection to a roll forward of liabilities. That's useful, but to me, you can't do an accurate or useful debt reconciliation unless you know that where the debt is and where the cash is and whether the cash can be moved to where the debt is to pay it. But I, you know, the net debt reconciliation is part of it. I'm sorry, the roll forward of debt is a bit of the information you need, but it's not sufficient, in my view.
Mary?
Some overlap with the comments Pat just made, and again reflecting on the discussion that I heard at the advisory group meeting. The theme that I heard in terms of especially frustration with the information people have available today were not understanding restrictions on cash. That was a message that I heard come through. And just looking quickly this morning at IAS 7, there is a section on other disclosures that talks about cash that's not available for use by the group, but the focus there is on if, for example, an entity is in a country with foreign exchange controls. And I think that's really one extreme end of the spectrum in terms of restrictions on cash. Certainly in the last several years, there's been broad discussion about the tax issue Pat just raised. Cash is in an entity that's in a very tax-efficient jurisdiction, but means that if you move it out, there might be very significant tax consequences. So that could be relevant. So I agree with the staff recommendation not to try and include a net debt aspect to the short-term project, because I think if there are significant challenges to that, and if we try it, it'll be a half-baked version of the net debt, and it will slow down the other things we want to accomplish. I think, however, to try and be responsive to some of the concerns we had in terms of what was driving net debt, potentially even in the short-term project, to look again at the disclosure requirements in IS 7 around restrictions on cash and see if there's anything we can do to pick up, you know, some of the other types of restrictions that might be relevant that isn't quantitative or roll-forward, but just highlighting other things that might remove some of the barriers to an analyst using the information to compute his or her own calculation of net debt. And so we can be responsive to some of the concerns we've had from people who are looking at this KPI, but I think we would do more harm than good trying to do it in the very short-term project.
In some of our new standards or old standards relate to a particular balance sheet item, we had or have a few disclosure related to restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want a holistic disclosure or in addition to the current requirement?
I think it would be possible, not too burdensome for the short-term project, to maybe go through and just say, okay, stop. What disclosures do we have scattered different places about cash? Think about whether they cover what have been some of the significant concerns raised in the last several years, more generally, not just in our project. And it might be a combination of minor amendments, highlighting recent developments, thinking about putting them all together without it being a fundamental reconsideration of that. But and it does fit in with the notion of rationalizing disclosures and getting focused on the right issues.
One comment. I guess we need to examine more about the analyst uses of this net debt. And Mary said, maybe we need to define the net debt. I guess if we just try to define the net debt, maybe it will be endless to finish this project. But as a approach like the conceptual framework, if we do not try to define, then we can finish this disclosure initiative much, much earlier. So we need to investigate how the markets are using this net debt ratio. I'm looking at the BP's annual report. They are disclosing this net debt ratio now, as you described in your paper. UK companies are disclosing that ratio. So I guess now that's the one I was suggesting, search some description, development description, rather than definition.
I think there's two views of net debt out there, and I think sometimes it causes confusion. There's kind of a solvency view of net debt and what cash is available to repay debt. And I think that's caused a lot of concern, because then you get into all the restrictions on transfer of cash, the tax implications, the rest of it. But I think the use of net debt that you often see is more of a leverage view of net debt. So borrowing increases leverage, having surplus cash reduces leverage. And I think that's more the view that these analysts are thinking of. Because obviously analyzing...
How is that different from a solvency view?
Well, it means that even if you have some cash that you physically cannot used to repay the debt, you would still regard the cash as reducing leverage whilst the debt is increasing leverage. So the physical ability to use the cash to repay the debt is of less importance than the leverage implications of it. But that's why, because of the difficulty of knowing what people think of in terms of net debt, because of the all the cash implications, that's why, and because of the definition problems, that's why I also think it's quite difficult to do a comprehensive net debt project, which is why I was suggesting a bit of a compromise, which is the roll forward of financial liabilities.
Ian?
Yes, I mean, it seems to me this paper has made a good case that we shouldn't be doing it in the short term amendment. And now there's a suggestion that we do something in between the short term and the long term. And so maybe the next step is if you could bring a paper to us next month on what a project like that, a scoping of a project like that. Not next
maybe
month.
Next month.
Posting deadline is Wednesday.
No, next.
But we need
you have a whole weekend.
Yeah.
but we
can sort of bounce it around on the run here, but, you know, I think it needs a bit of thought and consideration.
We'll meet you in the office on Sunday.
When we talk about the project, I think our first step has to be to really understand what the disclosure is used for and what can we produce in a good amount of time to meet that information requirement. And I don't necessarily think what we get out of that will determine what the disclosure isn't. In the end, and as I said, I think in CMAC there was a suggestion that maybe some short-term disclosures that we could get done quickly would be better than leaving something to the longer term. So I think what we're going to produce will be dependent on this project and what we find out within it. I don't think we're going in with we have to do a net debt reconciliation like company XYZ. I think we need to understand what's involved before we can even propose that.
Okay. I think we have agreement.
So let's move to agenda paper 8B, which is on amendments to IS1 as part of the disclosure initiative, and this relates to totals and subtotals. So in the disclosure forum, the feedback statement on that, we said that we would look at whether subtotals of IFRS numbers such as EBIT or EBITDA should be acknowledged in IS1. And this would address a view that certain such subtotals or totals cannot be presented or disclosed. Now, the staff view is that there are provisions in IS1, so paragraphs 55 and 85, which already enable an entity to make judgment, to disclose totals and subtotals where they provide relevant information. And there's also wording in paragraph 1.1.12 which says that an entity should provide additional information, again, if it provides relevant information. We do think, however, there may be confusion regarding how the totals and subtotals are fairly presented. So there is a concern that some totals and subtotals might be misleading or confusing. So therefore, we would recommend that additional wording is added to IS1, which relates the notion of fair presentation to the presentation of subtotals and totals and subtotals. And that's the question one. Do you agree that additional guidance is added to IS1 to clarify what factors an entity should consider when aggregating IFRS recognised amounts into subtotals and totals? And we've put a draft in the appendix, but that's to give you sort of an indication of what we're thinking in terms of that proposal.
Patricia.
I have some serious reservations about this, particularly looking at the wording, and I realize that it's not been polished.
Mm-hmm.
But my, first of all, I'm not sure, I don't know what presents fairly means in this context. Generally, I always think of something is presented fairly if it's presented in accordance with IFRS. So I'm not sure I understand how that would work. And it's further, it seems to me that we're almost blessing amounts that we might think or others might think are inappropriate. In other words, let me be frank, I think we may be seen as encouraging disclosure of income before all the bad stuff. As long as you tell me what the bad stuff you left out is, it's okay. And I'm not sure that we want to be seen as really blessing that activity. I'm fully supportive of companies disclosing whatever they want to disclose as long as they tell me what went into that total, but I'm very uncomfortable with us blessing that process.
Pat? Well, my observations are along the same lines as Pat. The concern I have, Christy, is you teed this up and you used the words misleading or confusing, mm-hmm. but those are not the words in the draft, and as Pat said, they're not polished, but in my mind, that's the litmus test. Okay. So the concern, again, I have is, as you said, we're giving license to companies to essentially score subtotals in their income statement of comprehensive income with this change, and I think that's not the place where we want to be encouraging this type of additional disclosure. I think this entire area is, as we just discussed, the subject for a medium-term project where we'll move the kinds of supplemental disclosures, I'll call them that, to schedules that would be in the notes to the financial statements, where if management wants to use these subtotals, they can, but they'll reconcile them to the GAAP amount. So as an example, I, as I see question one, I think you could still get to an argument that you'd be providing the key components of EBITDA, even though in the second question we're saying that we're not going to provide an example of that. And so EBITDA is typically used as a proxy for cash flow. And it's a misleading proxy for cash flow because it excludes working capital changes. It also excludes investment in CapEx. But yet it's used in the leveraged finance world quite extensively. And so not having a good reconciliation or explanation as to what EBITDA is, I think is a dangerous place in a type that we'd be perceived, I think, as blessing these kinds of things. So I think that I'm not supportive, frankly, of the direction you're going here, because I just think it opens up the potential for new types of disclosures that we haven't thought of, and as I said, I think could end up be contrary to the underlying principles in IFRS. So I would just move this entire area to this medium-term project and deal with it via supplemental schedules and disclosures. The other point I was going to make, I think it's a good one that Mary brought up, IAS 7, the cash flow statement. A lot of the disclosures that Mary mentioned, which are absolutely critical to understanding this concept of net debt, are encouraged. The actual language in the document doesn't require them. We just talk about these other disclosures around restrictions, and we say preparers are encouraged to make them. We all know how often they're made when disclosures are encouraged and not required. So I think this is an area also that we'd have to focus in terms of amending if we were to go down that path of coming up with a net debt reconciliation.
I'm more supportive than others, I guess, on this. I mean, I observed that we already have a problem with operating profit. It's not a defined item. It's arguably a non-GAAP measure, but it's very, very widely used, and to my mind, quite an essential part of communication of results. So if we were tolerating operating profit as a subtotal, why wouldn't we tolerate other things? I mean, operating profit is arguably profit before some bad stuff, because it doesn't include the bad stuff of taxation and interest. But nevertheless, it describes an aspect of the company's performance that I think most people would find extremely useful.
And most people think we have defined it, and we haven't. But if you talk to the average working analyst, they believe that that's a GAAP number that they can rely on and compare it company to company. They don't realize that it's...
I agree, which is why I think adding some clarity to how we deal with such subtotals would be useful. So the mere fact of requiring a company to describe what is in operating profit, what isn't, require a consistent calculation from one period to the next, and an explanation as to why they've done it, would actually be quite useful.
I agree, Steve. Wouldn't you, though, agree that that should be somewhere else and not on the face? In other words, would you be happy with supplemental schedules that would illustrate these types of subtotals and reconcile them in terms of what's going on?
I have no problem with operating profit being on the face. Now, you go further and further, and I start to become more uneasy. So operating profit before stock option expense, and then stock option expense and operating profit after stock option expense. So I feel that's okay. Well, I'm starting to get a bit uneasy, but I'm still okay, because as long as it's transparent, I don't mind a subtotal to be drawn at a higher level. Where I start to fall off is somebody says, operating profit with my version of stock option expense based upon, let's say, intrinsic value, and then adding in the other bit of the stock option expense that the standard setter makes me do, but I don't really think is relevant type explanation, then I sort of start to get a bit more uneasy. But I'm quite comfortable with there being subtotals to highlight different aspects of companies' performance, as we do at the moment with operating profit.
Yeah, when you read the staff's suggestion, it is the gist is disciplining, right?
Mm-hmm.
But your concern is that by disciplining it, we also provide a legitimation.
Yeah, very nice. Just related to that, actually, Hans, on page 9 of the paper, in paragraph 85, it's straight out of IS1 now. It actually states an entity shall, and I'll just shall present additional subtotals. You must present additional subtotals if it's helpful and necessary to an understanding. So we've actually legitimised it, and all we're trying to do is get discipline for that as well. And perhaps the position.
It seems to me that what's in one now is fine. That's why we get operating profit. I don't see why we have to go farther, because it's going to lead to the kinds of things. I for one don't think operating profit before employee stock compensation expense barely presents anything. So So we're back to what is fairly present. Steve and I disagree about whether that fairly presents anything.
And this language will permit you to do it.
So can I just ask the following question then?
It's permitted now, right?
It's permitted now.
It's permitted now at paragraph 85. Would it help if we moved it? And so instead of having this as a more of a general statement, take out the fairly presents and simply say, if you do present a subtotal, you must indicate what it's made up of, use it consistently, and so on. So what you because we have that legitimacy anyway, either that, or I think from what I'm hearing, you'd have to take that out. Actually, take out that other line item.
See, I think it creates clutter to use an often used phrase.
So the problem here is it must be fairly presented.
Yeah.
Then if they do it and they say it's fairly presented, we have sort of legitimized
yes,
it. While it might not give a fair a faithful representation of what is really going
yes,
on.
Yes, so it sort of turned what's in one now on its head. One now says you have to do it to provide the information. This says if you provide the information, it has to fairly present, which is the reverse. So right now it says you provide subtotals when it's
relevant
to an understanding of the financial performance. The way I read the draft, it turns that around and it says you can present any subtotal as long as you tell me what's in it.
And I'm fine with that as long as it's outside the primary. But that's a key thing.
So I'm still confused as to whether or not we should strike out those words in paragraph 85 or keep the words in 85 and make this a more agnostic set of list of criteria. So it's not about fairly present, but simply put some discipline around to say,
well, yeah,
if you have those, then do these five things.
The words in 85, I think.
Yeah, you know, it should basically say if you do it wrong, do it consistently wrong, right? but if you want to provide a subtotal, then at least you should be consistent about it and not change it from year to year.
And be clear about
and be clear what you are. But by the way, the fact that you use it and do it consistently does not mean that it will give a fair representation of what the actual performance of the company is.
But it needs to be a fair representation anyway, because there's provision in IS 1 that says that you must present fairly. So it's relevant. It's bringing in the conceptual idea of faithful representation and relevance together. So I think we thought that the provisions in IS 1, paragraph 85, already require you to provide it where it's relevant, but we thought some of the pushback and the concern around these subtotals is about how it's being presented and whether it's being presented fairly. So that's why we brought in the idea of fair presentation.
The fact that I know how it was calculated doesn't make it relevant.
But then you wouldn't disclose it if it wasn't relevant. You shouldn't be disclosing it if it's not relevant.
But entity's doing this.
Done.
I agree entirely with the proposal here, and I think we are not the masters of this. I mean, the last 15 or 20 years or so, people have changed a lot how they report. We have more and more sort of non-GAAP or whatever you call it. They're adding together GAAP information and non-GAAP information. Presentations are made the way management think it should be done. And I think what you are proposing for me is that we get a little bit of rigor around that, and I think that is good. When you compare companies today, you find that some of them have one of these magic short-form numbers and their letters, and they're not really comparable over time between different periods or between different companies. I think it's very good to do it. If we don't do it, it will just continue as today, and we are not masters of this.
Yeah, Gary?
I'm somewhat in between the views in here, if you could.
That's possible.
IES-1 does everything we needed to do today. But if we limited whatever change to, as John suggested, just a little bit disciplined, I think he'd live with that.
Yeah.
I think you really can't go further than that at this time. I mean, operating profit is, I mean, acknowledge what Stephen said, sometimes it's the number excluding things you don't want to hear about or the bad numbers, but I think a lot of companies will do operating profit is the day-to-day nuts and bolts operations. Then you've got capitalization costs called interest that are not part of operations. They're, in fact, very culturally viewed as very distinct and different. And so if you want to know what your day-to-day operations are throwing off, it's fine. And how you capitalize the company, that's not necessarily a bad expense, but they probably would not include that in operating profit. So I think operating profit, I think it's going to be sort of tilting at windmills, trying to define it, because it gets deep into the culture of companies, how they're organized, and their views of capital versus taxes versus operations. And I would be concerned, you know, about having, call it, big GAAP or IFRS charges, you know, big restructuring charges. They're often viewed as non-operating. Well, I don't agree with that, but that's sort of way, where the world is right now. So you don't want to set this up to do, you know, start positioning things that would typically be or commonly viewed today as non-GAAP measures. And then lastly, I think, is stuff like EBITDA and EBIT and stuff. I think it would be near impossible to have items like that in the face of the income statement. For example, the company might have depreciation in six different line items, you know, with cost of sales, cost of service, SG&A, and so on. So I think stuff like that either belongs in a footnote, belongs in management commentary, or you provide the information and have someone compute it. But I think it would be get very dangerous to start describing or requiring new subtotals and other common there today. And taking this and the net debt discussion, what I'm really coming around is probably need to reopen the financial statement presentation project. Is what that's sort of leading me to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess we all agree that to some extent non-GAAP measures are inevitable, especially since we don't want industry-specific financial presentation and rules. Putting some discipline to it would be good without necessarily blessing what the outcome is. I think that we have to make that clear. But something like operating income, where people, EBITDA, every in analysts know this is fishy, and you have to look at it very carefully, and that it leaves out a lot of bad stuff. But operating income, used by every analyst, and that we don't have a definition for that, isn't that a problem? I know that we have tried to tackle that problem without success in the past, but wouldn't it be worthwhile to have another go at it? If especially if people think it is part of our standards or a result of our standards. Impossible to do, Jan?
Well, I think it's as Gary said, I mean, we have this financial presentation project going for 3 or 4 or 5 years, whatever, and coming towards the end of it or approaching the end of it, I think we realized there were a lot of difficulties in addressing these topics. But I would be very positive of trying, but make it simple and focus on a couple of things, not cover everything.
Hans, there is a way to address everything that you just said. I completely agree with you. But I think we should move this forward slowly. And I'd be in favor of doing what some securities regulators around the world have suggested, which is we agree that non-GAAP measures are critical to communicating your story. Just don't put them in the primary financial statements. Disclose them in the notes, provide a schedule, and reconcile them to their corresponding GAAP measures. In my mind, that's a very sound, prudent way to kind of initiate this. And then, you know, if as we continue the financial statement presentation project, we want to put some rigor around the definitions, then we can start perhaps taking them one by one and then introducing them into the notes or into the primary financial statement. But I think we should kind of tiptoe into this rather than just jump right in and amend our standards Because we could do this very quickly. I think Stephen makes some very good points. This is desirable information. It's just a way, I think, of getting there expediently without having to create a lot of process around it. Then we wouldn't be blessing it. Martin?
I see the risk if you really do it in this way as proposed here, that a lot of this currently non-GAAP financial measures will become GAAP financial measures. And then my question is, okay, how all these rules, like the SEC rules, what Pat mentioned, okay, when you're using non-GAAP financial measures, maybe they are useful and helpful, but then there are rules like SEC rules or other rules by security regulators that say if you're using that, you have at least not using it more prominent than a GAAP measure. But if we're introducing all this kind of stuff into our standards, I don't know how people will distinguish between and how these rules, which are currently in place by, for example, the SEC, will work. And therefore, I'm in line with Pat saying, I think we should stick, I think, with what we have, and then maybe have some rules. If you're using that, like the SEC is proposing, then, okay, then you maybe can use it and disclose it, but not in the primary financials, and then do a reconciliation with the more adequate or common really gap measure. Because otherwise, if we introduce it, I think that rules will become very, very difficult, so the fair presentation rules. That is my concern. And because there is not any then standard to which you should reconcile if we allow all this kind of subtotals in our standards.
Clarify that. In the present situation, people can put these face. There's nothing to stop them. Except the regulators.
In fact, you're required to. Well, required to do something.
If it provides relevant information and also you do have to also have a fair presentation, and you are required to present that subtotal total on the face. According to 55 and 85.
55 and 85.
There will be times when that won't result in a fair presentation, and I think Mary brought up a point about EBITDA, depending on the way that you structure your income statement. If you do it a functional or a nature perspective, if you did it on a nature perspective, I think putting in an EBITDA wouldn't give you a fair presentation because you'd be mixing up your elements. But at the moment, otherwise, as IS1 stands, if it provides relevant information and a fair presentation, you are required to put it on the face of your primary financial statement.
Yes, I strongly support such proposal. I think it is necessary. The reason why is well written in the paragraph 15. Auditor discouraging, even though IFRS permits or requires, auditor is very cautious about doing this, and they are saying that these are non-GAAP measurements. So non-GAAP measurements cannot be audited, so you shouldn't write it down on the face. But I don't think it is right. There are two types of non-GAAP measurements at the moment. One non-GAAP measurement is non-GAAP measurement based on GAAP data, based on GAAP measurement. So this is just sum up or subtotal. So this is allowed or sometimes required. It is clear. But on the other hand, there are non-GAAP measurements which is based on non-GAAP data, non-GAAP measurements. So those are mixed up now at the moment. That is why auditors are so cautious. And your proposal is trying to clarify the difference between non-GAAP measurements based on GAAP measurements and non-GAAP measurements, what we call non-GAAP measurements, based on non-GAAP measurements. So the non-GAAP measurements, what we call now, based on GAAP measurements, is not a non-GAAP measurement, really. So you are trying to articulate that. I would appreciate that approach.
Is this a fair presentation of what you're trying to do?
we tried to steer away from getting into the debate about what a non-GAAP measure was, but I think there was a view that if you had a subtotal of recognised IFRS numbers, that wasn't a non-GAAP measure. Provided it met the requirements.
So profit for expenses will become a GAAP measure.
Well, if it's in compliance with IFRS.
But
I think it's a different connotation. You know, I think it's a very sort of
Yeah, I understand it, but I think it does not make sense.
Mary?
I think we've heard too much concern expressed by a wide range of stakeholders to do nothing, or to say we can't separate it from the financial statement presentation project, which is a significant project. But I hear the views of several who've spoken who've expressed a desire to be very cautious about what we do in this area, because, you know, if you just take today's paper, the staff thought that the proposal you're putting forward was to bring discipline to practices, you know, people were using today, and several people read it as blessing almost anything as you as long as you reconcile it. So some of it is just the communication around what we do. And, you know, Christy had sent you a note in advance of this saying, I think one piece that we're missing in this discussion is pulling in subtotals and other requirements of IFRS, like IS1, the if you do it by, I think it's by function, you would have a difficult problem separating out the six places. You know, some Gary, I can't remember if it was Gary, somebody else said, maybe Stephen, depreciation and amortization might be in six different line items. Therefore, how could you do a subtotal that is EBITDA, you know, on the face of the statement? And reminding people that you have to consider all of these things at the same time. There's another paragraph that you cited, BC 56, that you've reproduced here, that for me raises, in the discussion of not defining operating income, that for me raises the question of, if you think you can do EBIT or EBITDA, can you do that without presenting operating profit? Because, you know, do you have to do one to do the other? It doesn't quite get to the reconciliation point, but I think it raises itself. I think we should try and do something. I support the idea of trying to bring some discipline to what people are doing today, but I think we have to look very carefully at the message that we're trying to convey about both what our objective is and what the disciplines are, and pull together the different pieces of IFRS in this area. And maybe what we do is use it as an opportunity to ask the question that seems to divide the board here when we consult, which is, do you think that these items, you know, should be presented in, be permitted to be presented in the primary financial statements on the, you know, on their face, or should adjustments of gap measures, whether they are subtotals to exclude items or to adjust the amount, only be presented in the notes or outside the financial statements, and just see what a broad range of stakeholders, you know, says in response to that consultation. So I think we should do something. I think we should be cautious. I think we have to do more to integrate other requirements so that we're sending a clear message, and we can take the sounding on this primary financials or not.
Very good.
I not support, you know, for the following reason.
This step, recommendation?
Yes. I support you.
Who do you know? Who or what do you not support?
This staff, and he's supporting you.
Oh, okay.
For the following reason, you know. Firstly, you know, we should be very careful. Both IS 1 and 7 is a general standard. It's not industry specific. And EU say not be displayed with more prominence than the specific subtotal referred to in this standard. I don't think it is so appropriate, because, you know, there are so many different kind of industries, and they may have more relevant, useful subtotals, which people generally accept it. But it may not appear in IS1. Mm. And we should be very careful. This is general standard. And secondly, we have had a debate during the process to develop financial statement presentation project. That is the dilemma between management views or much more rigorous, you know, requirements. And some, we originally proposed purely managing views. And the people against us say, you know, it will result in non-compatibility. But then when we want to, you know, try to make it much more tight, then other people say, you know, you will present, you know, different things in a similar way. And I'm not sure whether, you know, hiding by this way will solve this dilemma. I feel hard to understand. Thirdly, I'm not sure how should we deal with the relation between our standards and the regulatory requirements. Assume U.S. is full adopted. And assume U.S. listed companies have to follow 10K, 10 others. You know, their SEC have so many, you know, tablets. And they disclose fine. And should we say, no, let's assume SEC disclosure requirement of some subtotals is not in line with us, or they're more. Can we say U.S. not become full adopter, or ask them to move those required into notes, say this is not the number. I feel hard to imagine, you know. And similarly, in China, Chinese SEC have some requirements, and normally the company would disclose in their accounting policy like this, in line with accounting standards, also in line with the disclosure requirements by the capital market regulators, or maybe banks will say in some areas in line with bank regulators. And my question is very simple. If U.S. is a full adopter, and we recognize SEC has so many, you know, much longer average on faith, and can we say you're not in line with, or we want them to put some of the items into notes because it's not in line with us?
I think companies do that now because I think a lot of the U.S. companies that report now currently under IFRS that used to report under U.S. GAAP often had the listings which SEC filers had required but kept them when they moved over to IFRS. Now that still aligns to IS1 because IS1 is very principles based, so therefore they can retain those subtotals and totals. And I wouldn't see these restrictions or this guidance being in contradiction to that, because I do think those subtotals and totals that they're providing are providing relevant information and a fair presentation and meet those factors that we set out. I don't think any of the subtotals take prominence over any of the small number of ones that we actually define in IS1. So I don't think there's a contradiction between the two, but that's my view.
Speaking just about the SEC requirements and not about other jurisdictions, the SEC requirements generally are pushing for or establishing when you have to have greater disaggregation of many of the line items that we have, rather than being focused on requiring or prohibiting specific subtotals. So I think that's the reason why I agree with Christie's assessment that the FX regs do not conflict either with IAS1 today or with the kind of changes that the staff is proposing.
So the Korean security regulators also expand or add some subtotals?
I was just giving you facts about your concern that we're creating conflicts today.
So yes. Yeah, generally I agree with the staff proposal, but in the case of the question one guidance on this non-GAAP measure, I'm just like suggest some kind of modification of your proposal. You are just suggesting a kind of a disciplining guidance rather than encouraging some kind of disclosure. The purpose of the whole initiative is to responding the market demand. They want more disclosure. More, but in this case, this guy is bringing a kind, giving us some discipline guidance. So it looks like maybe we are going against their market, their maybe the expectations. So we should be careful. We are encouraging more disclosure, if they are relevant or fair, but you maybe the first kind of positive statement must be come first before giving some kind of disciplining guidance.
Well, I suppose that the answer to question two will be very clear from the board. Mm-hmm. We agree with the staff recommendation to that it should not be amended to include specific examples of commonly reported totals, because that would go a long way towards legitimizing them. Mm-hmm. Then there are mixed views on question one, where I think that what Alan
I should say, would there be more comfort if two things, it's an edict. I think in the basic conclusion we would actually emphasise that this purpose is to get discipline and say the board expressed a concern that if this any way encouraged proliferation of long gap measures, they would not support continuing with finalising proposal. But also, would it be more comfortable if we actually move these to follow either paragraphs 55 and 85, or mainly 85, because I think it's income statement concern, because it then links it very explicitly with that requirement. And then it shows that it's not a general, you can add subtotals and do these things, but it's more of a, if you do add a subtotal, then discipline. And I think that's sort of more expanding for what we meet, you know, what characteristics go around that subtotal, as opposed to the more general requirement in paragraph 30. So geography actually matters sometimes in a standard.
I think that would answer, or at least go some way to address the tax concern about linking it to the relevance idea and making sure that you could only provide a total or subtotal if it's a relevant.
If it's relevant.
Yep.
And I'm concerned about the wording, because the way I read the way it's worded now, if you provide those disclosures, it automatically fairly presents. And I'm really concerned about that.
So,
right.
Just one question. I think the way I was reading Alan's recommendation, I think I agree, is that actually paragraph 85 is working, so it's linked, of course, to the conceptual framework, so everything should be a faithful representation. What is missing some kind of discipline on how. Is. So what you are proposing, Alan, let me just understand this. What is in 31B, the letters A to E, would be actually a sort of language that we would add to paragraph 85. Yeah. So in a way that we are not talking about the first phrase here, much fairly presented, we cross this out, everything. We just concentrate on the should, and then go to letters A to E, right? I think this could work perfect, because then you encourage some consistency in the way you calculate and present it.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. April.